Welcome back to the Jane Q Public Podcast, where we discuss topics related to the intersection of technology, civics, and American culture. Today's guest is someone I'm excited to talk to because if you know me, you know that I love the First Amendment. Ari Cohn is the Free Speech Council at Tech Freedom, an organization that digs deep into the hard policy and legal questions raised by technological change. Welcome, Ari.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right. So I am stoked to be talking to you because, like I said, I love me some free speech. And I also spend a whole lot of time worrying about how speech and, you know, and all information is being impacted by our technology, which I feel like we've adopted so quickly. And so we are going to hear all of your wisdom, because if anybody spends time on this, it's you. I mean, you are into it. So, but the first thing
I'm also a very big online person.
Yes,
I'm
a
super online person.
Yes, yes. I know. It's funny because so am I. And it's one of those things where you're like, half the time you're disparaging it, and the other half you're like, I could never live without this. So yeah, I don't know. Okay, first of all, I'm going to ask you an icebreaker question. Are you ready?
Oh, I'm ready.
Are you sure?
No, I am sure.
What's the last book that you read?
Oh, so the last book that I read was actually a book about free speech and social media, believe it or not. The new Jeff Stone and Lee Bollinger edited book, which is really kind of a collection of pieces, most of which are deeply silly and confused, about the First Amendment, free speech, and how social media platforms are impacting it. I have been on a mission, and I've been unsuccessful so far, to get back to actually reading things for pleasure instead of hate reading things that relate to my professional work. But I haven't been able to do it so far, and I'm really trying to, but, you know, we're going to get back to it at some point or another, because I'm tired of always being in this space in my head.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's hard to find the time when there's always episode reruns of Roseanne on some nonsense channel. It's hard to say, okay, I'm going to turn off my brain by doing something intellectually stimulating instead of laughing at late 80s, early 90s sitcoms. You know, it's a tough call.
Yeah, you know what? That was such a good show. It was so well done. And I actually like going back and watching old TV to see how it holds up. And some of them are just terrible. And some of them are like shockingly still good.
I mean, on a social level, Roseanne was ahead of its time.
Yeah, for sure. The only problem I have with Roseanne is that she once tried to sick all her followers on me.
Well, yeah, she's kind of had her personal travails in the past few years, but yeah, you know, that's kind of one of those things. I'm one of those people that can separate the art from the political positions of the person making it, and that kind of, you know, probably is a function of my, you know, decade-long free speech career. I can separate and I can enjoy those things. You know, I think Roger Waters has some absolutely banana pants views, but I still love Pink Floyd.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree with you there. Look, I understand. And I want to actually, this is a really great jumping off point, because I feel like the world that I was raised in, and to be sure, it was not an ideal world. There were lots of terrible things that happened to people who were in minority communities. There was a lot of marginalization for, you know, all kinds of folks. Like, it was not an ideal world. Plus, we were being raised by boomers, and, you know, they had that whole suck it up type thing. They were not necessarily a nurturing generation. But it seems like, and I don't want to be that person that talks about the good old days, because they weren't that good. But also, there is, in my opinion, a troubling difference in the way that people view differences, right? In the way that people express themselves as if anyone who disagrees with you is a terrible person. And maybe that's always been there. Maybe I was just naive. I don't know. But what I feel is that, like, this isn't just punditry anymore. It's really seeped into the general population. And I can see people sort of becoming really, like, harshly critical and actually attempting to marginalize people they don't agree with. And I don't know how to feel about that. I feel really uncomfortable because the reality is differences exist among all of us.
Well, you know, that's kind of one of the reasons why I like to not say the good old days. I think the more accurate phrasing is simpler times, to be honest. And, you know, they were simpler times. There's absolutely no doubt about it. But, you know, I think to some extent you're right. Your suspicion that this kind of otherization of people who disagree with you on anything always existed to some extent. And, you know, I'll kind of preface this by saying I am not a social psychologist. I'm not a sociologist. I have no formal training, so this is all my surmising. But, you know, I think that our ability to communicate instantly with pretty much the entire world, if we wanted to, certainly has an effect on the way we talk to other people and the way we view other people. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, but I think it's an objective reality that we can't ignore.
Absolutely. And I think the part that I'm really trying to get at here is that it's not about differences, because we always, I mean, you know, you grew up, you went to whatever community you went to, whether it was a church or a synagogue or a school or whatever. And there were always people there that you hated, right? That you were just like, oh, that guy.
Yep.
But it was less of a, you still kept going back because you had a shared purpose and you just kind of, you built up a tolerance to it. And personally, I think tolerance gets a bad rap. I think tolerance is the way that we're able to live with people that we can't actually claim to love, right? And people are like, tolerance. But tolerance has gone way, way, way the hell down.
Well, I think we also don't have a shared understanding of what the word tolerance actually means. I think people come at that word from different approaches, which might, you know, be why it gets a bad rap. But I don't think, you know, a lot of people would say tolerance is saying, not only am I not going to think you're evil for disagreeing with me, but I'm going to basically tacitly agree with everything you do. But that's not tolerance. And I don't, it's clear to me that you don't think that's what tolerance is either. But, you know, I guess that really all brings it back to the fact that on so many different levels, we don't necessarily, at least anymore, have shared starting points.
You know, I've been married for 22 years to the same person. And I'll tell you, I have to tolerate some things. Right? Like there are some things that I don't necessarily like and that I wish would just stop and go away.
As but, the person who is tolerated, I'm sorry.
No, but I mean it works both ways, right? That's the reality of living with other people. And what's so the thing that I really feel like gets overlooked in this conversation is it's really an infinite amount of diversity, right? Within humankind. And so even if you get rid of the people that you think are diametrically opposed to you and your ethos, it's going to end up in conflict again, because there are still differences within your subgroup. You know what I mean? And so, you know, and I've seen this, I've seen like internet forums or groups where, you know, people go there to get away from the terrible people, right? And they end up just imploding and infighting. Just because the people that you think are your enemy are out of the way doesn't mean that there's suddenly going to be this harmony and everyone's going to agree. There's tons of ways to disagree if you're a human being.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, kind of harmony is a vastly overrated ideal, to be honest. Life would be super boring if we all just only talk to people who agree with us and who we think share no fundamental differences with us. I mean, maybe I am just that kind of asshole that likes fighting with people or something like that. But, you know, I like talking to people who have different positions than me. You know, I've never been the type of person that can say, I would never date somebody who didn't share all of my political beliefs or something like that. You know, it sounds really boring to me, to be really honest with you.
No, I completely agree with that. And I guess I feel sort of, I kind of feel like an outsider holding that view.
Well, if anything is certain, it's that we've become a much more you're with me or you're against me society. I would say for better or for worse, but that's pretty much always for worse, in my opinion anyway. And, you know, it's there's certainly at least an apparent lack of ability to just accept the fact that people don't believe like we believe and to deal with those differences in a healthy and constructive way instead of just writing people off wholesale.
Yeah. Is that a privileged position? Is that a squishy, gooey, centered position that nobody likes? Or is that the reality?
It is a privileged position. It is, you know, undeniably, you know, there are some people whose experiences do not afford them the luxury of agreeing with people who say want them dead. I 100% acknowledge that is in many cases a very real position. And that's, you know, there's a lot of nuance in these things. And there's a lot of nuance that we kind of evade by face value, superficial thought processes that, you know, I guess are probably in some way magnified by the fact of, you know, that we have instant communication with everyone.
Yeah.
We don't slow down and think about the different positions. And I literally just did that when I said, you know, we have an apparent lack of ability to deal with differences. You know, that was in itself an instantaneous, off the cuff and pretty unnuanced position. And that's kind of the way we seem to think these days. And, you know, we can always do better.
For sure. Part of the concern that I'm experiencing at this point isn't that people are free to express their displeasure if someone is outright, you know, racist or homophobic or, you know, any of the nasty things that people can be. It's that everything now suddenly gets dialed up to those things, right? When there's if there's a disagreement, let's take free speech, for example. Right? The second you come out and say, I am a supporter of free speech, I think that people should have as much free speech as is absolutely possible without destroying the fabric of society. And I think that we should be constantly vigilant against attempts to curtail that freedom. And suddenly it gets dialed up to, oh, so you support Nazis.
Right? Yeah, everything's because, an extinction level event.
Yes, yes. And to me, that's just not like, how are you going to self-govern like that? You can't. So what are you? Oh, okay, let me just ask you, what are your thoughts on that? Where does that come from?
I mean, that actually hits something that, you know, I often tell people and try and grapple with just myself is, you know, there's a big difference. I think in disagreeing with someone and then making that disagreement nuclear. And when I say there's a difference between those two things, what I'm thinking of is on one hand, you have people that I think are rightly concerned that maybe attempts to rile up online mobs and destroy someone's you know, livelihood or get them fired or something can be, and sometimes for, you know, maybe somewhat mundane remarks that people find offensive, others might be more severe. But I think there's, you know, there's a proper criticism of that. Like, hold on, slow down. What are we doing here? Let's think about this for a second. And then there are the people who, you know, whine that cancel culture is expressing your disagreement with someone or walking out of a speech silently in protest or something like that. And, you know, those are two very different, fundamentally different things. And, you know, we kind of have ratcheted everything up to, you know, everyone thinks that everyone wants to be able to speak freely and nobody wants anyone else to be able to criticize them.
Right.
Freely. You know, that's the eternal paradox, but, you know, I share your concerns about kind of everything being an extinction level event. I think it's not conducive to actually working through our differences because it doesn't leave any room for working through anything. And, you know, this is not a new problem. We've always struggled as people with, you know, who is worth working through things with and how do we do that? And, you know, there are people who always claim like, hey, like, well, if you throw the word racist out there, you've effectively ended the conversation. And that's what it's designed to do. And maybe in some cases that's true, but in some cases, certainly it's not, you know, right. And so it's like, it's an interesting dynamic because you have two different extinction level events, quote unquote, coming at each other. And you know, hitting each other in the middle. And what does that leave you with? That just leaves you with people who are just more convinced than ever that they're on the side of right, and that the people that, you know, disagree with them are not. And you haven't really gotten anywhere. You've made a big fireworks show, but, you know, nothing actually got done. So, right, you know, it is concerning. And I don't know how to fix that. You know, humans are going to human no matter what. And, you know, that's strikes me as just something we've got to figure out, just on a basic societal level, how we want to think about these things. But at the same time, one of the things that I'm even more concerned about is when we start getting government in the mix and people saying, well, we have to have government tell us how to resolve these disputes, because that just goes down the worst possible path for resolving anything, is getting the government involved.
Why do you, I want you to explain why you think that is, because I have my own sort of set of beliefs around that. And I'm mystified, truly mystified by people who have unwavering trust and devotion in the government, any government, right? Why do you feel that way?
I mean, really, it's funny that I even have to say it, because for asking, you know, basically anybody, either Democrat or Republican, they think that either the current or the previous president is the worst we've ever seen. Why would you want to hand the apparatus of the government, who is either in the hands of the people that you despise and think are the worst people ever, or just was and could be again, why would you hand that apparatus the power to make these decisions for everyone? That makes no sense to me. And, you know, I'm going to tie this back to social media, because, you know, people have strong views on content moderation on social media platforms. Are the platforms doing it too much? Are they not doing it enough? How are they doing it? To tie it all in, I think that a lot of the decisions that are made, either action or inaction, are significantly worthy of criticism. They screw up, and of course they're going to screw up. There's, you know, billions of pieces of content posted every day. They're going to screw up. And I think we ought to call that out. But the worst possible thing we can do is say, the government should tell us, you know, should tell the platforms how to do that. Then you just get this manipulation by whoever's in power for whatever aims that they want to use it for. And it doesn't even necessarily, I do think eventually it would be malevolent, but it doesn't necessarily have to be. It can just be a function of government incompetence, which, you know, is something we see all the time. But, you know, there's no greater affront to the concept of free speech than handing the government the reins of what we can say or what other people can say and how these things ought to be resolved. You know, we can argue till the cows come home within society, outside of the realm of government, about what is protective of free speech and what isn't. But I think the one universal thing that isn't is handing control to the government. That's just a terrible idea in every respect. And we've seen how it's a terrible idea.
On one hand, people completely understand that power tends to corrupt, right? It does. And no one is immune to that. There is no one who is immune to being corrupted by power. And on the other hand, people are like, well, I want somebody to do this for me. And so then they try to hand authority up to the power. And
yeah, it's
that
kind of chicken shit, pardon my French.
It is. It is. And I also think, and maybe I'm not a I'm not a sociologist either or a historian, but I do think democracy is not a comfortable thing for us, right?
Nope.
It's still the idea of self-governance, the idea that we have a stake and a responsibility in what happens in this country or in our cities or in our states or wherever, is a really challenging thing. Historically, it's not been that way for most of human history, right? There's always been a top-down power model. So trying to inculcate those practices, and democracy is a practice, right? It's something that you have to engage in regularly. It's something Absolutely. That you have to show up for on a regular basis. And it's something that you have to, that is going to make you uncomfortable. And that's a hard sell in America, my friend, where people really do not like being uncomfortable.
Yeah, well, you know, also like there's, again, I preface this by saying I'm not a psychologist in any sense of the word, but a lot of anxiety that people seem to experience comes from that, you know, decisional paralysis of, oh my God, what if I fuck up? What if I make the wrong decision? Then it's all on me and it's all my fault. It's much easier to outsource that decision making so that if something goes wrong and a bad decision is made, we don't feel as directly responsible for it. And you know, it kind of helps our psyche a little bit, probably, to be able to externalize the blame for that instead of saying, well, I made that decision personally. Of course, you know, it kind of ignores the fact that when you vote for somebody, you've effectively made that decision personally. But, you know, it provides a buffer layer, I think. And, you know, when we ask government to do things for us, we're basically saying like, oh, you know, what if society, what if, you know, without the arm of the government pushing us in one direction, what if we make the wrong decision? Yeah, we're going to screw up. That's fine. Like it's just going to happen. And if people are saying, oh, well, the government's not going to screw up, I'd like to know what planet they're living on.
This is an interesting conversation because I just read this morning, and I'm sure you must have read the same piece about the Saudi activist who wasn't even really an activist. She was a dental hygienist or something, who ended up getting 34 years in jail, right? Or in prison. Plus another, I think, 34 years travel ban from the Saudi government just for sharing, resharing what other people were saying. Like she was sharing what activists and, you know, critics had to say. She's, you know, feminist and whatever. And people in this country look at that and they're like, oh, barbarians, right?
Could never happen here.
It could never happen here. And to me, help me explain. I want you to explain how that does happen. It's not a function of like just because people are brown or on the other side of the planet, right? It's a very human tendency to want to be in control. And the more control you have, the more of a threat any kind of difference is.
There's a famous Oliver Wendell Holmes dissent in Abrams versus United States. And I'm just going to read the quote because I think it's powerful and it's very, very point. Persecution for the expression of opinions seems to me perfectly logical. If you have no doubt of your premises or your power and you want a certain result with all your heart, you naturally express your wishes in law and sweep away all opposition. I think he really kind of hit that human tendency, you know, nail on the head. That's what we, you know, if we have strong beliefs, yeah, of course, we would naturally want everyone to have to believe that because we think it's the truth, capital T, capital T.
Mm-hmm.
When we enlist the government, and you know, I wish I could say it wasn't the case, but basically throughout all of our history, in different cases and in different circumstances, depending on who you ask, there's always been somebody who wants the government to punish the thoughts that they don't like.
Right.
As much as we like to say that maybe we've grown in our free speech protection, and, you know, as far as the court's concerned, it certainly has. But as humans, I don't think we're really that much more advanced than we've ever been. I think we still have that base human instinct that, you know, the things that my deeply held beliefs are, you know, the truth and the way, and everything else ought to be suppressed. And, you know, obviously not everyone feels that way, but I think if as a general, as a human race, I don't think we've really outgrown that. I'm not sure we ever will. And I think the best way to protect against that is to absolutely and to the most extreme measures feasible, without, again, destroying society, remove any of those avenues from government control and power. I think it's a dangerous road to go down, and we ought not experiment with it.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to agree with this too. And I know, look, I know the power of words. I mean, even now, like, we call ourselves a free society. We have the First Amendment. Not all speech is free, right? Like, not all. There are some things you can't say, right? There's libel, and, you know, there's a lot of things that it's not a free for all. And so I guess, you know, part of our challenge is finding or maintaining sort of this tension between, because things change. And that's where this conversation about technology comes in, right? The last 20 years, we've had an exponential adaptation to a whole new way of communicating and receiving information. And we're using 20th century brains to try to process it. And, or, you know, 80 billion years ago brains. I don't know. like you said, I don't think we've gotten that far either. Like, we're really...
Personally, I'm using my lizard brain.
Always a good one. We're trying to process things that cognitively we just are not capable of processing. And in that situation, what do? Is we look for shortcuts immediately. Right. Yep. And we start, or you try to make everything, just sort of throw everything in one generalization. Okay. That's fine. Generalization, where you're just like, yeah, I mean, you know, all Republicans are Nazi lovers. That just makes it easy.
I want to go back to something you said a minute ago, because I think it's important. And this is something that I speak a lot about. And you said, you know, words are powerful. And yes, they are. And that's why, you know, I spent more than half a decade at the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education doing free speech on campus work. And I did a lot of presentations to college students, both conservative, liberal, and everything in between and outside. And the one thing, if I was going to ever make a point, the one thing I really wanted to drive home is that it is not an affront to the idea of free speech to acknowledge that words are powerful and that they can hurt. That is, and that they can do damage, you know, if we're not careful. That's not only not an affront to the principles of free speech, it is the reason why we protect it, because words are exceedingly powerful and they hold a lot of value. And yes, they can be used for good or they can be used for great evil. But their power, their inherent power, is why we protect it. And we can acknowledge that some speech is less than ideal, and maybe we can criticize it and say that speech is not something you ought to believe or say. And we can do that without saying you should not be allowed to say that. Those are two very different things, and we need to separate them, because, you know, that criticism is sometimes how people change their beliefs. To that extent, you know, I think the explosion of communications technology over the past two decades, and really the explosion maybe only a decade, you know, I think that there's a lot of room for powerful good in that. I think we can be exposed to things and to ideas and to people that we would never be exposed to. We can use it to learn to empathize with people around the globe who are facing things that we will never have to deal with. And, you know, we can harness it for good, and there's going to be bumps in the road, and some people are going to use it for bad things. And, I'm still bullish on the wide communication and interactive possibilities that technology has brought us. I'm not a pessimist in that regard, although, mm-hmm. you know, I certainly sometimes may seem like it. But I think that there is such great possibility, and it's on us to make of it what we will. The technology is not inherently good or bad. It is what we make of it, as is life.
Two things to respond there. One, if words are power, where does the power belong, Ari? Tell me, pop quiz.
With all of us.
With the people.
To be honest. Yes.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
There's nothing more powerful than people finding common cause with each other and mobilizing in support of it. And sometimes that can go poorly, like we saw on January 6th. And sometimes that can go phenomenally, but we can't dispute that it is powerful and we ought to be able to do that with one another.
Right. The other thing, there's a study that I often cite, and you may have seen it or heard it. I think The Oatmeal even did a comic about it. Or it was part of one of the comics, and it was done at USC by a group of neuroscientists, and they put people inside a MRI, and they scanned their brains, and they scanned them to see what would happen when the researchers read statements that contradicted their deeply held beliefs, the subjects' deeply held beliefs. And what they found is that the same areas of your brain that fire off when people say things that violate your deeply held beliefs is the same areas of your brain that fire off when you are being physically attacked. And so what we have is this unprecedented access to every opinion under the sun in a highly addictive format, right? So people can't or won't step away. And that causes them to be in this state of hyper anxiety, right? Either fight or flight, right? Like they're, or freeze, the people that just go away altogether and are like, I can't even hack this. So what I think is so interesting is that we're not taking into account, there are psychosomatic impacts to digital technologies that we haven't even begun to study. Like we have no idea what the impacts of all this have been. Like you said, it's been maybe a decade, two decades at the most, like 15 years, maybe. I don't know. Like it's been a very short time, and it happened so fast, and we all just jumped on the train and adopted it. And now we're kind of stuck in this, you know, hellscape that we had no real thought or input in. None of us had the opportunity to be, you know, at Facebook or at Twitter, and you look at people like, oh my gosh, like Jack and Mark, right? Like you look at those guys and you're like, these guys, do you want them controlling your speech? I mean, really?
For me, I'm kind of a chaos Muppet. So I don't, you know, I kind of get some kicks out of the way it is, but you know, I do want to push back a little bit on the addictive thing.
Okay.
Because that for me is kind of the hallmark of every single form of media since media has been invented. It wants to keep your attention and it wants to keep you engaged. And yes, it looks a little bit different on social media, but the end result is the same. It wants you to keep consuming information. And it might be slightly different than saying information is addictive, but at its base, that's kind of what you're saying is that, you know, the way that we're consuming information is addictive. And I think for a lot of people, that is a compelling backdoor to allow the government to slide in and start controlling things. But I don't really think that we want to be declaring something like a choose your own adventure book is theoretically addictive in the same way. It wants you to keep going and figure out how you're going to proceed. Having a cliffhanger before a commercial break or at the end of an episode is designed to get you to come back and consume more. I mean, this is the way that when people are transmitting information, we want people to keep coming back for more information from us or from, you know, whoever it may be. So, you know, I think it's a little bit, I think it elides some crucial issues to, you know, say that social media is addictive. Unfortunately, most of the ways in which people are using it is, well, we have to be able to regulate it or sue the platforms for addicting us to this communicating with one another. And I think that that's a specious contention, and even more questionable grounds for regulation by the government. So, you know, that's getting a lot of play lately, though. So I just wanted to say that.
I mean, I understand that, but I also feel like the big mistake that we're making is that we are looking at social media and just digital in general as a product for consumption. And it is not. This is a very different thing where you have the ability. We are all media producers now. And yep. Anyone who's done any studies on mass communications knows how powerful mass comms are. But nobody, like the vast majority of people using it, have no real knowledge, training, understanding, or have any idea what could go wrong with mass comms. There's no background there. And so it feels like a bunch of toddlers with firearms out there sharing stuff that, frankly, the majority of the stuff that I see is, well, the majority is just people trying to sell shit, whether it's products or ideas. The other thing is that people are not thinking things through. Like it's become ideally, look, all right, ideally, if you have a group of thoughtful people and they're all in this environment, they're going to find ways to come to a common sort of agreement about these are our norms, right? Every group that I've ever been part of, every class, every whatever, there's always this point where everybody sets norms and says, okay, this is how we're going to engage with one another, right?
Yeah, try scaling that, though.
That's the problem, right? So you have like this incredibly porous environment where anyone can see anything. I mean, we're talking, I could tweet about, you know, my toast and some jackass in Russia on the, you know, on the other side of the planet is reading about it, right? And they know what toast I had for breakfast. And that's like innocuous. That's not like, you know, I feel like people are just going out there and like giving away their everything. And smart people are able to take that information because they know how to use it. They know how to use mass communications and leverage it against us or anyone who's just out there engaging without any sort of, you know, training or background or purpose or anything. It's just sort of, you know, we're just using it. We're not, I don't know. You tell me. You know, am I off?
Yeah, I mean, you're right in that people certainly can be injudicious about what they give away. And, you know, yes, is there room for some kind of manipulation by the powerful and the moneyed and the, you know, what have you? Sure. And I think that's the case with everything, though. That's been the case with talk radio. It's been the case even with books. You know, if you have the money to publish the books and flood the market with your ideas, you know, you can do that. And the TV stations figure out their viewer counts and what advertisements are doing well and what have you. You know, there's always, you know, metrics behind it. We can be more careful on a personal level about, you know, how we use social media and how we navigate these new means of mass communication. But, you know, that's on us. You know, people ought to think about it and maybe they won't change the way they're using it. Maybe it's fine with them, but, you know, at least then they'll have made a conscious decision. You know, I think we ought to encourage people to really think hard about what they're doing. I don't think that's problematic remotely. In fact, that would be a net positive.
Kind of. I mean, that's, you know, that's kind of what I do as part of my program. And I feel like it's just really hard to convince people that they need something because they don't know that they need it. They're just, any idiot can sign up and get a free account, right? What could there be to it? And so I don't know. I think that there will be sort of a righting of the ship in another generation or two.
Oh, that's a big assumption that humanity is going to last that long.
Oh, you are from Twitter, aren't you? I mean, maybe we won't, but humanity will be around. Somebody will be around. I guess it's one. It's like Photoshop, right? When Photoshop first came out, everybody was like being duped all the time, and people were sending email forwards with these photos, and you know, it was just.
And then we learned how to kind of be more critical.
Yes, exactly. So I think we need a time. I think there is just people aren't thinking about how the technology works. And this is definitely an entirely different layer. I mean, you're giving information away on the internet, whether it's consciously or not. Anything you do on the internet belongs to somebody if it's not on your server and your website. And so I guess, you know, that's a hopeful thing. And I do think that we have the opportunity to grow into it. But in the meantime, a whole lot of shit could go down, like really bad shit. Right. And I see it kind of inching its way that direction. And I'm really uncomfortable with how tenuous our position is.
Let me make you a little more uncomfortable by saying that without social media, we'd still find a way to fuck things up pretty bad. this is basically just another avenue that we have created for ourselves to figure out and screw up along the way. But if it wasn't this, it would be something else. You know, we can't help ourselves. That's the way we are. And I don't think that we're in a position where we can say, if we didn't have social media, society would be just fine. I don't think that's the case.
Oh, no.
And, you know,
I don't either.
I think we're going to figure it out eventually. And yes, there are going to be growing pains along the way. But, you know, that's how we do it. And frankly, that's kind of, you know, also the principle behind free speech is that bad ideas might win out temporarily, but there's a faith that eventually, you know, good ideas will hopefully win out. And well, if we don't believe in that anymore, then, you know, we might as well just throw everything out the window and start from scratch, because what do we have left? There's a little element of faith involved, I think, but I don't think it's unwarranted.
No, look, I agree with you 100%. Like, I'm not a burn it down person. I also am not anti-social media.
Oh, yeah, and I'm just on my soapbox.
No. But, like, I feel like we are, I don't know. I agree. We'll find ways to fuck things up. I agree with everything that you're saying. I think there's just a little more tension than I would like, because the future is so very uncertain and it's in my face all day, every day.
Yeah. Right?
When I go online. I think that's why the free speech conversation is such a hard sell, is that in theory, it all sounds wonderful, right? Yes, we should protect this. Yes, it's people can be idiots and we need to find a way to just ignore them or find other methods for getting them out of our face. But in a situation where we are now, where we're constantly in that hyper-vigilant state and feeling attacked all the time because we just don't process differences. And look, you and I are of the same breed in that I am not nearly bothered by differences. I like, you don't like me, okay. But a lot of people really, really are very upset when people say bad things about them. I guess the point is we're all dialed up to 11 because we're just not wired, you know, pun intended, to process all the shit that comes at us, whether it's innocuous or not. Like, we're just we've overdone it cognitively. And so in that environment, trying to convince people to give free speech the open road is, I think, incredibly challenging.
And you know what? And you're right. I think it's always been challenging for a lot of the human nature reasons that we've talked about. Yeah, I think maybe the increasingly tense and hyper-polarized and anxiety-inducing world we live in can make it an even tougher sell. But, you know, if there's one thing that we should all remember is that we are doing this to ourselves and nobody is making us do it. We have the ability, each of us, to dial it back from 11, take a deep breath, maybe take a break from social media, or maybe just change how we think about when we see a tweet that enrages us and how we process that. We have the power. to change those thought patterns and those actions for ourselves. And so if we have a problem with it, we just need to look in the mirror because there's your culprit. But, you know, I take the point that everything seems so uncertain. There's so much bad shit that everyone is constantly seeing on the horizon that might happen, that it makes it really difficult for a lot of people to say, okay, these people should be allowed to say these batshit crazy things. Because when you look at it, some people are already thinking four steps ahead to when those people are successful in achieving their goals and have complete world domination and are imposing it on everyone. You know, that's kind of the, everyone's got that doomsday scenario in their head. And it makes it hard. But, you know, if we go down that road, it's the people that are, you know, feel the exact opposite way that you do are also going down that road. That's not a tenable situation. That's just a situation where everyone's trying to use the government to impose their particular views on everyone, which is what we want to avoid in the first place. You know, we're literally going to end up, if we, you know, take those doomsday thought processes to their natural conclusion, creating the problem that we are seeking to avoid, which is just deeply ironic. And people are, you know, humans are short-sighted creatures. We don't always think, you know, through the conclusions and the possible outcomes of what we want to do. But we can turn down the volume if we want. We can stop and take a deep breath, and we can find a way. And this is kind of another thing that I've really harped on over my years, is you never win people over to the cause of free speech by bludgeoning them with it. You got to meet people where they are. You have to acknowledge their concerns. You have to address, or at least try to address, their concerns, make them feel heard. And that's how you're going to win people over. It's like persuading somebody for, you know, any other purpose. If you want to convince people that free speech is the way, you have to meet them at their level. And that is different for every, you know, a lot of different people and a lot of different subsets of the populations. You know, nobody ever won marginalized communities, you know, over to free speech by hitting them over the head with, well, you know what? It is good and proper and right that we say that you should be allowed to, you know, use whatever slurs, you know, whenever you want. And maybe that is the ultimate position, but if you say it like that, you're not going to win yourself any new adherents. You've got to say, like, yeah, these words can be destructive and harmful, but here's why defending the right to say them is going to lead to better outcomes in the end. Or here's the danger in not doing that. You got to give people a reason.
A lot of times people go to the government regulation as a default, right? That's, it's just easy. Like, that just makes, yeah. But there are other ways. It's not an either or. It's not, you know, the government takes control, or people can just say any horrible, terrible thing and yell fire in a crowded theater. Right.
Oh no!
There other mechanisms. Analogy. I had to work.
Edit that out. Edit that out.
But like, there are other mechanisms, right, for addressing the issues that affect us in our society. And I wonder if you have any thoughts on what are some non-government ways to address bad speech.
I mean, there's the classic, there's the counter speech, and I am a firm believer in counter speech, and I acknowledge that that's itself a privileged position, and I acknowledge that it doesn't always work, but it's a powerful tool, and we ought to be using it at every circumstance. A lot of people point to, like, content moderation from the platforms and whatnot, and, you know, I have kind of conflicting views on it. On one hand, I 100% believe that, you know, these private platforms should be allowed to make these decisions for themselves. They have the right to do that. They have their own First Amendment rights. On the other hand, you know, maybe they ought to, you know, have a little bit, you know, lighter of a touch. But on the other hand, it's impossible to forget the fact that they're running a business, and they've got to appeal to advertisers, and they've got to appeal to users. So they have that consideration. Mm-hmm. You know, it might be an easier dichotomy and binary if you could just say, oh, if they weren't running a business and they were just kind of running some kind of, you know, thing out of the goodness of their heart for the sole purpose of allowing people to speak, which is, you know, I guess sometimes how they might have tried to portray themselves, but they've always been a business, mm-hmm. first and foremost. That's just always been yep. what it's been. And so you have that different consideration. And so, you know, it's really tough because you can't really rely on, you know, the platforms to, and I don't think we should want necessarily the platforms to be deciding, you know, what speech is valuable or invaluable. They're going to make that decision based on their business interests. And, you know, who can blame them for right. that, I guess. We ought to be teaching people how to be more media literate in the digital world. You know, I'm a big proponent of media literacy programs. You know,
do you think they're effective?
You know, I couldn't tell you. All I know is that it's something we can try that doesn't infringe on anyone's rights. And yeah. why not give it a shot if we can teach people how to, you know, and again, I guess we've been trying to teach grandma not to believe that chain letter that says she's going to die if she doesn't forward it to 13 people by Friday afternoon or whatever. And that hasn't gone so great. So, you know, I'm not saying that's a, you know, a silver bullet at all, but it's something we can try. And, you know, I think if we can kind of teach people how to, and not teach people what sources to believe or not believe. You know, that's how some people mm-hmm. construe media literacy programs. And to an extent that people think that that's what they're doing. And if they are, like, that's not what I think they should be doing. I think right. we should be teaching people how to analyze the information that they are bombarded with on a daily basis, how to research whether or not that information is true. I don't want us to be teaching people, well, if it's from this source or if it's this information, just assume that it's false. People ought to be exercising their brains a little bit and figuring it out for themselves. You know, that's one thing.
That's right.
You know, that's right. But it's also so much of this. So many of these problems could, you know, we could address at least in part by each one of us just, again, taking a deep breath and like calming down for one fucking second. You know, we're doing so much of it to ourselves.
Yes. But you know what's an even harder sell than unfettered free speech in America?
Yeah, taking a deep breath.
Personal responsibility.
I know.
Like, ain't nobody want to take responsibility.
And, you know, I'm as guilty of it as anybody. I sure. love a good hate read and then, you know, firing off a snarky tweet. You know, I love that. But I also, you know, maybe I'm kind of being a little bit elitist here by portraying myself as above it all, but I also don't kind of look at Twitter every day and think, oh my God, the world is ending. How can we possibly go on with all these people who disagree with us? You know, that's kind of not my approach. I kind of take social media for what it is, and that's really kind of just a giant joke. In a lot of respects, yeah. You know, I don't know. It's so complicated. Undeniably, people say when they're looking for government regulation, we don't know what this is doing yet. First of all, for me, I think that's a good reason the government should stay out of it, because if we don't know what we're doing, the government sure doesn't know what it's doing, and you're only going to screw things up further. But, you know, yes, yeah. there's like another couple of decades worth at least of self-exploration and figuring out how this impacts us. And we need to just not be afraid of that. Yes, there could be some bad outcomes along the way, but we'll figure it out in the end. And, you know, if we don't go down that path, you know, what does that say about our willingness to advance and progress and innovate? You know, that would just bring it all to a close. If we're going to be too scared to hit those bumps along the road because, you know, we don't want to have those bad outcomes, we're going to stop progressing. And that's not, you know, we need to free ourselves from that fear, because the only way we're going to get through this is by going through this.
Boy, you said it. And, you know, that's not just about speech. It's not just about America. It's really just sort of, you know, a whole ass life lesson right there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I agree. Like, you know, I have like teenagers, 19-year-old twins, and watching them go through things, you know, that for them, you know, are majorly stressful and upsetting and like anxiety producing, that for me are nothing because I do it all the time, mm-hmm. right? Going to get a tire change or whatever. But at the same time, I know that if I don't let them have that experience and feel that and then conquer those feelings, then they're not going to be good adults. They're not going to be self-sufficient adults. And yeah, I mean, I think that that's true. It's just a terribly...
it's uncomfortable.
Scary prospect. Yeah, because things can go wrong. They will go wrong, like you said. And, you know, we are marketed up to our eyeballs with an idea that we're all customers and everything should be to our satisfaction. And
well, we also,
the reality is that's not life.
We're also being told at an increased rate by, you know, the people who would, you know, have the government step in or do this or that. You know, we're increasingly told that we are helpless in the face of these powerful corporations. And that is not remotely yes. true. You know, first of all, beyond the baseline that we have a choice whether or not to use these social media platforms, and we could literally all just decide not to if we really wanted to, something right. that people just don't seem to remember. But we also have options. We have our own personal choices about how we interact with the platforms and the people that are using them. You know, we have a lot of agency, and we are not nearly as helpless as the people who say that government needs to save us from the evils of big tech or whatever, would have you believe. We have a lot of power, both as consumers and as individuals. And we can't forget that. And we can't neglect to use that agency, flex our own brains and muscles, and just really make decisions for ourselves. You know, if you're worried about being guided into things by other people, it's as easy as not letting them. You just have to really hunker down and think about things and put in the work. And that's the thing, is most people just don't want to put in the work.
Well, I think also one of the things that we need to be tasked with here is really understanding the technology that we're using. You know, the internet is limitless. It's not a finite space. And the fact that millions of people have camped out on a handful, literally a handful of platforms, and are fighting about them is a clear indicator that people have no imagination and idea of what is possible.
Yep.
Right? You don't like Twitter? It's not even that great of a platform. Just go, let's build a different one. Let's build a better one. You know, learn from those mistakes. We can go somewhere else. Like, everybody could literally have their own platform if they wanted to. But I don't think people want, again, it's like democracy. People want to have those benefits, but they really are not clear about the fact that you have to invest in it. You have to be part of it. You have to be engaged with it, and you have to be willing to sacrifice for it.
And this is kind of actually something that I'm going to tie back to something I said at the way beginning. And, you know, it kind of informs some of my conflicted feelings. And that what I said was, I think life is so much more interesting with people who disagree around me.
Yeah.
For that reason, you know, I kind of understand why the anti-big tech censorship crowd is mad that they, you know, and doesn't just go hang out on Truth Social or whatever. It's because they want those people to piss off that disagree with them. They want that audience. And of course, they're not legally entitled to that audience, but I can understand, like, on a psychological level, why they would rather be, say, on Twitter than on Truth Social. I can relate to that in a way. You know, that might be one of the, you know, one of the few ways I can relate to some of those people, but I get it. And you know, you can say what you will. You know, people say, "Oh, network effects prevents anybody from really being a competitor." I don't think that's true personally. But even if you take it as true, the platforms that were big a decade ago are not the platforms that are big now. Like, the internet is so dynamic and so constantly evolving that. Right. It, like, 10, 20 years from now, it's probably going to seem quaint and antiquated. The idea that you would type some words into a web browser and tweet them out. Like, we can't even fathom the ways in which we will ultimately end up communicating via the internet. It's almost certainly not stopping with what we know now. There's so much possibility out there.
I completely agree with you. You know, I'm so passionate about technology in general because I do think, I mean, I see so much opportunity. And we've all just sort of rushed into these very finite, like I said, handful of online spaces and attempted to recreate all of our offline institutions and media and everything in this space.
We haven't busted through the paradigm yet.
Exactly. Exactly. And I'm really excited by people who think outside, way the fuck outside the box about these kinds of things. Because I do. I think that there
is. And a lot of people like to like brag on those people for having these wild, crazy ideas. Personally, for me, I'm like, great. Propose all the outlandish, wild ideas you can. That's how we're going to get something new and cool and exciting. 100%. Why would I make fun of that?
Yeah, 100%. Like that's how it's done. And that's how it's always been done. Every person who's truly changed the world or made a huge contribution, people thought, oh man, that guy's a wacko, right? And there's always been, you know, science fiction is a perfect example where people were just like, ooh, that's just so fantastic. Like that's not even possible. And yet now we're walking around with Star Trek communicators.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
Like, I mean, possible. Lots of things are possible. We just don't want to see that.
We are too focused and stuck in the world as we know it to see the world as it could be.
Right. Right. And, you know, I don't want to take too much of your time, but I will say this, and I'd like to hear your feedback about it. I think that I want to say we're in a liminal space. I really think we underestimate how much has changed in the world in a very short period of time and how little has changed with the human race. And
yeah.
And so I think it's going to take a while for those two things to resolve. But I also think...
And I don't know if they ever will.
That's
kind of the beauty of it.
Yeah, that's possible. Right. Yeah, maybe. Maybe that's true. I mean, maybe that's how we test our humanity. That's how we grow as humans, is to have to be constantly...
I mean, it's kind of funny that we're like... to think about technology dragging the human race forward. But we also, you know, can't forget that we're the ones that are creating the technology.
Right.
So when it seems like technology is dragging us, it's really us dragging ourselves.
Yeah. Well, I like that point of view. I think that's very optimistic. And I am by my nature an optimistic person, which is also probably not great. I should be more of a realist. But I think technology is getting a lot of flack right now. And I think it's because just don't know. It's
easy to blame it.
Yeah. Yes. It's this nebulous idea that there's these overlords. It's the same thing. You know, like people do this with governments too.
Back in the day, people blamed sex for all these things too. So, you know.
All right. Well, like, yeah, that's like, I mean, that's true though. No, I'm just kidding.
We're always, you know, we're always looking for that, you know, one thing that can explain all of our societal woes. And that's kind of just what we've been doing since we've ever existed as human beings. We want that one thing that we can blame, and we're always struggling to understand and grapple with our place in the universe. And I think this is kind of somewhat of an existential exercise. You know, we're trying to really grapple with what it all means. And, you know, to say, okay, well, the technology is making us do all these bad things can be a useful crutch for a lot of people, but it's just that. It's a crutch. It keeps us from having to really answer the hard questions about, like, what the fuck are we doing as humans?
Right. Ooh, I think that's right. I think that's right. No wonder I was excited to have you on. I agree with you on so many things. I really should look for more people to disagree with me on my podcast, but alas, it is not you. All right. Well,
you'd be the first person to find me agreeable.
I think we're just cut from the same cloth, and I appreciate that. Thanks, Ari. This has been such a great conversation. I know, like, I can't believe how fast this went by. I'm kind of bummed.
I know. I just looked at the clock and I was like, wow.
Please do come back for another episode then at some point.
I would be more than happy to. This is a ton of fun.
It was. All right. And I'll make sure to share, you know, your website and your social media and everything with my audience in the show notes so that they can find you and follow you and not give you a hard time on the internet.
Well, they can give you a hard time. I'm at my best when people are throwing rotten vegetables at me.
Oh, that is a rare breed. A rare breed indeed. Yeah. No wonder you love Twitter. All right. Well, thanks so much, Ari.
Awesome. So happy to have done this.